My name is Richard. I'm an alcoholic. Most people call me Dick. I served as a panel 51 alternate delegate in Southern Illinois. Our seat of delegate was Richard B. Our area chair was Dick M. And collectively, we were known as those three dicks from Southern Illinois. There was a sheet for announcements up here, but whoever did the last meeting took it home as a memento. So we're going to kind of wing it. The topic on our discussion today, our panel discussion, is how it works. And there just happens to be a chapter in the big book, chapter 5, that's named How It Works. There are some of us, myself included, who came to the AA program thinking that we were a group of people who hung around together, went to meetings, and did not drink. And that's what I did for 6 months. And then when I got suicidal again, some friends of mine took me to the side and said, you know, that's not what we're all about here. We read How It Works in each meeting that we do, except this one, of course. And it says on there, the following steps are suggested as a program of recovery, and it goes 1 through 12. It doesn't say anything about conferences. It doesn't say anything about meetings. It doesn't say anything about a lot of the things we do. What it says is work our 12-step program. Kind of gives us a little hint at the end, too. You know, it says, step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. When I concentrated on not drinking, life was extremely difficult. Even not drinking, it was extremely difficult. When I concentrated on getting right with the world, that need to drink went away. Big Book tells me that I have an allergy to alcohol coupled with an obsession of the mind. That allergy to alcohol is pretty easy for me to take care of. I don't take the first drink. I don't need the second or more. That obsession of the mind is a little tougher for me to deal with. I need the steps for that. I didn't lie, cheat, and steal because I drank. I drank because I lied, cheated, and stole. For me to not drink, I have to not lie, cheat, and steal, at least as much as I used to, you know. So the steps helped me do that. I am so grateful that I found this program. I'm grateful to have been invited to chair this meeting today, too. I bet I'm not going to drink all weekend. It's going to work out just right. So our first speaker is going to be Scott L. from Tennessee, followed by Reggie J. from Rhode Island, and Helen H. from right here in Canada. She's celebrating Canada Day with us. So I'll get out of your way and let Scott fill you in on what we all need to know. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Scott Lee, and I am an alcoholic. And so honored to be at a gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous. A fellowship touched my life, changed my life, gave me a life, and today is my life. And I love you with all my heart. And I'm really very moved to be here, and I'm really going to be glad to be here in about 20 minutes. I'm a member of the backroom group in Nashville, Tennessee. And I'm very proud of my home group. I hope you love your group as much as I do mine. And the chapter How It Works has got some powerful stuff in it. And in 20 minutes, I don't propose to be able to cover but just a small portion of it. But some parts of it that scream to me I want to talk about. My sponsor told me originally when I finally was sick enough to get a sponsor, I was so dry that they weren't smoking near me. And he said, you're too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I, of course, didn't know what he was talking about. And he read me the definition of the program here in the basic text on page 59, where it says, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. He said it was very clear to him that the steps were not part of the program. The steps are the program. And that we're committing murder with a little phrase. And the phrase is, don't drink and go to meetings. You'll die from that one. preaching to the choir, huh? Good. One of my mentors, and I have his wife's permission to use his name, Don Pritz, died earlier this year. He touched my life. Yeah, what a beautiful guy he was. And I asked him about the changes he'd seen in AA, and he said the thing that scared him the most is that today our focus seems to be on sobriety. When he first got here, the focus was on recovery. And there's a massive difference. Sobriety is simply not drinking today. recovery is this whole spiritual thing that for me is covered in what is for me the most powerful promise in our text. It's the first line of page 60. It says 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Pretty powerful stuff. It's my experience that spiritually awakened alcoholics don't drink beverage alcohol, no matter what, and they don't ever get thirsty. And that was the peace I could never find on my own, as I quit several thousand times on my own. I'm a puker. Do any of the pukers in the house?
Yes.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Nose pukers? Can you ever come out your nose? Few. Okay, well. Nose pukers always quit forever. And, right? But I needed to be able to be changed into someone who simply doesn't get thirsty. And that process happened for me through following the directions in the big book as they were laid out by my sponsor, because he told me that was the way it was going to be. He said, you're going to do the steps, work the steps, take the steps. It's not learn the steps, understand the steps, or believe the steps. Or interpret, did I leave that out? Ooh. He said, actually take the actions prescribed. And he said I was going to do them the way he laid them out at the pace he set, or I could get another sponsor, because he didn't work with losers. He scared me. And I surrendered to the man, and I'm so grateful today that I did. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to work the promises and hope the steps came true. Yeah, you know, walking around pretending I had all of that stuff, and maybe it would come true. Maybe you're familiar with it. You've probably seen someone who tried that. And I want to talk a little bit about step four, which, by the way, that's one of our best kept secrets. The four steps actually in the big book. And it lays it out very clearly what to do. And I'm going to talk a little bit about one portion of that, the portion where I have personally seen more lives change than everything else combined within the work. And so I have a passion for that part of it. And the perspective I take is that this is how I coach men that I sponsor through this part of the work. I'm not telling you what to do, but this is the only way I know to present it. If your sponsor disagrees with me, I believe your sponsor's right and I'm wrong. And I mean that. I think God blesses sponsorship. So you can't use what I say to beat your sponsor up. Don't shop it. But I extract from the men that I sponsor the statement that you want what the people who wrote this book had. And what they had was long-term, productive, happy sobriety. We call that recovery. That's, you know, it's all of those things and a lot more. That you want that. If you do want that, then I have to believe that you'll be willing, as we go through this book, if they say they wrote something, you'll write it. If they say that they prayed something, you'll pray it. If they say they observed something, you will endeavor to observe it. And so I've extracted that from them. And then as we get to step four, I find the fourth step to be a series of lists, observations, and prayers. It's my experience that the writing portion of the fourth step has very little effect. The observations and prayers are life-changing. I hope you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, please find someone that just grinned and nodded. It's powerful stuff. But first three directions. Number one, we need a list of people you've ever been angry with. Number two, we need to know why. And I limit them to 19 words. If you read under the cause on the first one, that's how many words they use. So 19, that's it. And then we do an inventory of what did it affect on your grudge list. For me, the action in step four that's so powerful occurs between the third and fourth columns. And it is the forgiveness process and the sales presentation that goes with it. And the first thing it says is the first thing, if I'm on page 65 in the text, the first thing apparent with this world and its people are often quite wrong. Okay, we're not going to dwell on that. You were on bar stools for several decades doing that one. If that was going to take care of this, it would have been taken care of a long time ago. And then it says, it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Is that plain to you? Have you ever seen a life that was full of deep resentment that wasn't also futile and unhappy? I've never seen one. Not just you, but anybody. It says, to the precise extent that we permit these, that we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. Did you ever lay awake at night and hate them? Did you ever sit in class and plan how you were going to get them instead of listening? You could have been filing your nails, right? Even in the retarded class, right? I mean, everybody, right? Okay. And then it tells me my hope is the maintenance or growth of a spiritual experience. I think growth means what I've already got is insufficient. Maintenance means two things. It means I can't afford to lose what I've already got. It also means that I must maintain in the same sense that I maintain my vehicle. Rotate the tires, keep the right pressure, and change the oil to do the things that maintenance my spiritual condition. If I'm going to stay spiritually awake, I'm going to have to stay spiritually active. And that's what maintenance is about. And it says this business of resentment is infinitely grave. Boy, those are powerful words. Infinitely grave. I think they just threatened my life. We found that it is fatal. No, I'm sure they did. That's twice. It says, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of spirit. It doesn't say when having such feelings. Harbor means to give a safe place to. We're going to talk to me later about how to quit harboring those feelings. It says, the insanity of alcohol returns. We drink again. With us to drink is to die. That's three. If we were to live, all right, this is only for the ones that want to live. Everybody else is dismissed. We'll catch you at the next one. That's the fourth time they threatened my life. We had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. About the time this book was being written, a man named Walt Disney came up with a really neat idea for writing Mickey Mouse cartoons. He had all his creative people sit around at a table and spit out ideas. And he labeled that process brainstorming. I found a dictionary from the 1930s, and it said, brainstorm is a transient, violent mental outburst. That means rage. It means rage. It's not creative. I mean, I'm told I'm created in God's image. If I'll tell you one thing for sure, God's creative. So, and that clarified this for me. So there's two kinds of anger. There's the grouch or the slow burn, and the brainstorm or the rage. So if they're not for us, this is thin. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men. For alcoholics, these things are poison. Yeah. Okay, we just threatened your life again. We're trying to get your attention here. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. Does that mean if I don't find a key to the future, I don't have a future? I think we threatened my life again. Prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. Now, the last time we looked at the list was at the beginning, where it said that worldliness people were often quite wrong. Now we're going to look at it from a different angle. And I thought we were going to see my part in it. It never does tell me to look at my part in it. That's not in here. It does tell me later to look for my mistakes, but that's very different. It says, let's have a look at how these things dominated you. Let's go down the list and have a look. Did you plan your life around these people who did these things to you so you could be around them in case they made a mistake? You could point at it and make sure everybody knew. Or did you plan your life so you'd never be around them so they couldn't get to you? Do you have the experience that I had, that your father beat you down so hard and so long and so fast that you still have trouble at 62 years old with authority figures? How did these things affect you? Let's have a look. This is a sales presentation is what's going on here, in my opinion. It says, in that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real. Oh, you mean some of this just happened in my head? Yes. Had the power to actually kill. Oh, we threatened me again. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered. Now, wait. They saw the resentments must be mastered. Do you? Are you convinced? I'm a salesman by trade. I think Bill was, too. And I'm not claiming to speak for him. But I'll tell you that a good salesman will never, ever mention price until he's established value. We just threatened your life 7 times on this page. Was that sufficient? I hope we've made our sale here. And the reason that we did that was because the price is very high. We're going to ask you to do some things you are not going to want to do. So we've told you bet your life. And it says we could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized this is the beginning of the forgiveness process. Or that's what I say it is. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. We realized. It's different from knowing. When I realize something, I know what my wife calls it heart knowledge. It's where something becomes real for me. We realized people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. And I was told to think of the 2 or 3 worst things I ever did. I'm going to ask you to do that. I ain't going to call anybody. Bring them up in your mind. Weren't you spiritually sick to have done that? My mentor Don defines spiritually sick as cut off from God. So I have something the angels don't have, the ability to turn my back on God and go right back to doing it my way. And that's how I was when I did those sick things, weren't you? Yeah. Had you been connected, conscious contact with this glorious God that created the stars and the galaxies and the duckbill platypus, could you have done those things? No. No, probably wouldn't have even thought of them, and they wouldn't have either. And this is the beginning of the forgiveness process. And I ask the men that I sponsor to at this point, go down your list one at a time. Beginning first by praying and talking to God about the 2 or 3 worst things that you ever did and how spiritually sick and cut off from Him you were to have done that. And then, one at a time, ask God to help you grant them spiritual sickness rather than SOBism, is what I call it. Let's begin there. And then having come down your list that way, top of page 67 says that we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us. They, like ourselves, were sick too. It's so important they told us twice. They're sick, and so are we. And then here's a prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. We're asking God to change me with that prayer. Help me show them tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I refer to the back of the book as the More Will Be Disclosed section. I hear it called More Will Be Revealed, but I can't find that. Page 551 is the story of freedom from bondage. The lady is talking about a resentment against her mother, and I want to look at the sequence of events here. Not only the prayer that you're familiar with, but the sequence of events, because I think it's predictable. It says, one morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it, it being the resentment against her mother. For my reprieve was running out. A reprieve, by the way, is a stay of execution. Got you again. My reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out to me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to take to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them. A banner across one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the word resentment. Let's take a look at the sequence of events. One, she sees something about herself that needs work. I didn't say something wrong. I believe we're children of God and there's nothing wrong with us. There are some things about me that need work, and you'll have to decide with the things about you. Two, she prayed about it, talked to God about it. Three, she focused on helping somebody else. Four, her answer fell out of the sky on her. I believe that is a predictable sequence of events. I've seen it over and over again. Sometimes a nice thing to add to the sequence is talk to my sponsor or another mentor about it, somebody else who walked in the spiritual path. Something about me needs to be changed. Pray about it. Talk to somebody else about it. Focus on doing something for somebody else. My answer when I come outside is laying on the hood of the car. It's a predictable sequence of events. Then it says, on page 552, he said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, that's the question, have we made our sale? Do you want to be free of it? If you will pray for the person or thing you resent, you'll be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you'll be free. As for their health, their prosperity, and their happiness, and you'll be free, even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. It goes on to say that'll work in 2 weeks. That hadn't been my experience. But this lady was down to one resentment, and I started with 162. And that was just the first list. I've had the experience. So in this portion of the prayer, what I'm actually doing is praying for someone else. I ask the men that I sponsor to begin about a 30-minute prayer session with 5 minutes of prayer, talking to God about the worst things they've done and how they were cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and then go to the first name on the list, named Fred, for example. God, please help me show Fred the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And then pray all the things that you'd like to have for yourself. God, I pray that he gets promoted at work, that he wins the Tennessee lottery, that his wife is a fabulous lover, that his kids don't give him any trouble and they go to school on scholarship, that his lawn grows lush and green, but it grows so slowly he only has to mow it once a year. Right? And I also tell them, if you have to preface your prayer by saying, look, I'm not asking you to lie to God. If you have to preface your prayer by saying, look, God, this idiot you've got sponsoring me right now said to do this, I'm going to do it just to prove it doesn't work, I'm good with that. I don't have any problem with that at all, because it works. And then I ask him, when they finish that prayer, to ask yourself a simple question, do I mean that? Does your heart really hope all that good stuff happens for the guy? If the answer is no, go on to the next name. If the answer is yes, put a check mark in one of the next names. You get to the end of the list, start again. I don't care how long this takes. We'd bet your life on this. My perspective is that the English language has it wrong. We use the word forgive like it's something I can do, like I can give my watch to him. I did bring a watch. Yeah, that I could give something. Forgiveness, in my experience, isn't something I do. It's something I receive. It's something I receive. I think of resentment as ice around my heart. And the thickness of the ice is maybe due to how long I've had this particular resentment or how much I've nurtured it. And what I do in prayer is I hold the icy heart up to the sunlight of the Spirit. And maybe depending on how closely I can hold it and how long, eventually the sunlight of the Spirit will melt that. And I will be in a place where I am right this second, where I'm not mad at anybody. I don't have any old anger. I'm clean on that stuff. And I feel good about it. I haven't forgiven them. I have received the gift of no longer hating them. I hope that made sense to you. There's some powerful stuff. We pray a prayer at the end of a lot of meetings. I understand that's under attack, by the way. And I notice it's under attack here. And we're going to talk about that. But one of the phrases in that prayer is, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I think that says, God, if I don't forgive them, don't you forgive me. I think that's exactly what that says. My sponsor told me when I was new that what I really wanted was mercy for me and justice for everybody else. And he explained to me that the package was justice for everybody or mercy for everybody, and that I am part of everybody and that I get to choose. And I don't know about you. I am not in a position to face justice, and I'm never going to be. I have consequently chosen mercy for everybody, and it has freed me. It has absolutely freed me. I'm a different guy. This fourth step is about digging poison out of your soul. That's exactly what had happened to me. If you're new to AA and you look at the steps and it looked like they're designed to punish you, welcome to AA. That's how they look to all of us. The book goes on to say, I'm going to skip a little bit of stuff here because I'm running out of time. But it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. How am I going to do that if I still hate them? How can I do that if I still hate them? I can't. We resolutely look for our own mistakes, not for my part in it. If I've prayed these prayers and the forgiveness is in place, their part's done. If I'm saying I've got a part, then I'm saying somebody else has got a part. I'm not looking for my part. I'm looking for my mistakes. That's what it tells me to do. And it tells me that twice, and then further on down, it says we place them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs. Honestly, we're willing to set these matters straight. Interesting how our program interweaves. That sounds a lot like step eight, doesn't it? Sounds a lot like it. I have been so blessed to have sat at the feet of some of the real masters of this thing. And I would like to close with a quotation from Don that I talked about earlier. I had the privilege of spending Thanksgiving with him this past year. And I was finally able to ask him the question that scared me. And the question was, what are guys like me going to do when guys like him are all gone? Terrified me. And he gave me that little grin and laugh, you know, some of you know. And he cupped his hands like this, and he said, I have been bringing you hands full of water. Go to the river. And I believe that's what AA is about. It's about teaching us all in our own way to go to the river. God bless you. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott. Very, very good. Next up would be Reggie J. from Rhode Island, a gentleman I just met this morning.
My name is Reggie, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi there. Wonderful being here with all of you. This is sort of a chilling experience to be up here, just looking out at all the faces and recovering folks from all over the world. That is such a blessing. You know, that is the real blessing. I came here with a whole busload of people from Rhode Island. And we're here strong. We're feeling good about recovery. We're feeling good about working the program. When you speak about how it works, we're an example of how it works by what we've done by being here to celebrate AA. We do it, and I do it another way, by making sure that I participate in meetings at all times and affect people whenever I can as it relates to staying sober, getting sober, and helping people to do that kind of thing. I'm one of those alcoholics that was a low-bottom drunk alcoholic. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. The first time I came to AA was in 1960. Now think about it. Long time ago. And the way I got here was because some guy came to the prison where I was at on vacation. You know. Hadn't long been there when this guy showed up and said, I hear you have a problem with alcohol. And I'm here to see what I can do to help you to get out of here. Man, who got a problem with alcohol? Was my response to that. you know. And so this guy didn't back off. He kind of hung in there with me, and he said, look, here's the deal. I'll see what I can do for you to help you to get out of this situation if you're willing to come to and try out Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went along with that deal, and I actually was released from prison to my surprise. Really. And that was the end of the deal, so I thought. I got over, so I thought. And this guy showed up at my door. Reggie! Reggie LeBeer! Oh, man. I was not pleased with that. He was coming to collect dues. Really? And so my wife ran around and got me some clothes together, and there I was off to my first AA meeting. Scared to death. But of course I got there with this guy and I smiled a lot, you know, and that's that big old cover up, you know, play that game. And this guy, named Almo, was sitting there ready to speak. This was a little guy, 900 years old. And he got up and took the podium and said, get honest with your drinking, you bum! Oh, Jesus. Scared the hell out of me. He really scared the hell out of me. You know? And he said about, where are your friends now? Where are your friends when you're at ACI? The Adult Correctional Institution, for those who don't know. Well, he really got to the core of me, you know. Now, this guy certainly drank for many years longer than I did, looked more terrible than I did, but somehow he had a message for this alcoholic. He was the guy who affected me in terms of the spiritual aspect of what this program talks about. And I began my process and my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got a lot of help from a lot of people who came up, made sure I had a ride home, and made sure they picked me up the next day. Wasn't that I really wanted that, but maybe I did. And so that began a long process of starting to recover, going to meetings, and participating. To me, that's how it works on a constant, continuum basis in Alcoholics Anonymous. But of course, I went along and hung in there for a while, but there are a lot of things I didn't do that the program talked about. It was like I did the first step in the 12th step. You know, busy rapping. I was always a rapper. You know? Really, get over. And so I used that same format in AA, but that was the format. The format was that they didn't have at that time a lot of discussion groups. They had groups where you really sort of carried the message the way that I'm doing here at the podium at the moment. And it was a lot of, not only that, but going to people's homes and 12-stepping people that way and carrying the message. It meant many times that I felt like drinking at the time that I was trying to tell somebody else not to drink. But because that guy and I were together helping this other person, it kept me sober. It kept me taking a look at myself over and over again at each person that I was able to assist in helping them to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. But somewhere along the way, I got off the scale of it and began to go back to my old way of thinking. And eventually, of course, I went back out and drank. Drank after a year. I drank, got back in the program, and drank after about 7 years of recovery. such a soul sickness alcoholism is. Such a soul sickness. That I was willing to give up wife, home, family, job, and any success that I had made as a result of getting sober. That I was willing to put that out there. Because I thought it was all about just staying sober and getting on with your life. I didn't really want to have much to do with other parts of the program. In fact, I avoided them. Like, you don't think I was going to tell anybody my inventory? I mean, get out of here. Certainly, I read some of it, but I was not in a place in my head to think that that was going to do something for me in terms of helping me. And so, of course, I went out and drank until the point where I was in a place of desperation. And perhaps desperation is the place that many of us have to come to in order to get to a place where we can accept help. And so that place happened for me. And it happened for me after a lot of drinking and a lot of knockdown and a lot of drag out, a lot of losses, tremendous losses. And so I was sort of out on one of my drunks in a sort of weenie joint. A guy came in from AA and he dropped a card on me. It was a date of time card. And he came by, said a few words to me about what about getting back in the program. And of course, I wasn't in a place to hear that. But there was a day that I was able to pull that card out and give that guy a call. And I was in real deep trouble with myself. I was also at a place of possibly going back to the adult correctional institution. And so I was able to come back to the program by giving that guy a call. He brought me to my first AA International Conference in Montreal. Very powerful experience for me. I was half mocus, but I was at that conference. And that was the beginning of my process of getting sober again. The program in action is what it's really about. And that's where I got really involved in AA, really jumped in. I jumped in terms of working in groups of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got very involved in helping to set up groups, and we had a tremendous group in our community of young people. And that group grew until we were able to put together a conference, Young People's Conference in Rhode Island. Just tremendously. What happened at conferences was that we were able to get down into the steps. I mean, each meeting was set up to really deal with steps and to talk about the steps and to be able to sort of cry together and heal together. A tremendous amount of healing went on for me where I was able to just let go of a lot of deep feelings that I had held on to for many years. I also was able to work with my sponsor, really get involved in the steps. Not easy work. Very difficult work. So I would say that I presently have 33 years in recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. That means a whole lot of work has gone on for this guy, a whole lot of change. That I was able to marry again, that I was able to go back to school. I got a master's degree today. That I was a guy who had dropped out of school. The tremendous things that have happened to my life as a result of recovery is unbelievable. I think that how it works has a lot to do with how you're living AA in your daily life, how you're passing it on, how you're giving it to others, how you're getting outside of yourself, letting go of that selfish self that we have, that I know about. To let go of the soul sickness, to allow someone else to care about me and to love me and to hold me. It's about freedom, you know. It's about not only getting well, it's also about staying well. It's also about embracing a spiritual life. It's also about not just talking the talk, but walking the walk. Really walking the walk. And each of you that are here, for me, is an example of how the walk is being walked. We together stay sober, not I. The name of my group is I Can't, We Can. Thank you.
Well, Reggie's comment about let go of the soul sickness, God, that describes me to a T. I had that so bad. Our next speaker will be Helen H. She's a Canadian native here. Let's welcome her.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Helen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm just delighted to be here this morning and to see so many people. My home group is Mileta, Manitoba, Canada. And somebody told me this room holds 2,500 people, and that's more than twice the people that live in my town. I always say when I went into the treatment center that everybody in town knew where I went before I did. I just came from the World Service Meeting breakfast, so I'm still on a high from that, and maybe a little emotional. I was also privileged to be one of four speakers at the trustees' dinner last night, and I was the first speaker, and this morning they put me last, so that's AA telling me to keep my ego in check. But I was privileged to serve as trustee-at-large for Canada from 83 to 87, and Don Fritz was the trustee-at-large for the USA. And, of course, the World Service Delegate also. And I didn't know until just a few weeks ago that Don Fritz had passed on. When I went into the treatment center in Winnipeg, Manitoba, for women, in November 10th of 1970, probably the first words that I heard, certainly not at my first meeting, or probably not at my second or third, but eventually, maybe after the first week, when they said, rarely have we seen a person fail. And I had never wanted to fail at anything in my life. And in the beginning, in the first years of my life, I didn't fail at very much. I was a good student. I was a good employee. I managed to do most things well. Until alcohol took over my life and my life started to go to hell in a handbasket, as the saying goes. I probably drank for 7 years, and four of those 7 years were totally out of control drinking. And during that time, I met the man who is today my husband, and we lived together for 3 years, and we got married a year and a month before I sobered up. Now, I'm talking about the late 60s, and it wasn't exactly the in thing to do in those days, and certainly not in a small town. And on October the 1st of 1969, we got married because my husband thought that maybe if we were married, I would feel better about myself and I wouldn't have to drink anymore. And the next year of my drinking was probably the worst, and the bottom was coming pretty quick. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a very sick cookie, I'll tell you. I got to the point where I couldn't eat. And when I got here, I weighed 108 pounds. I'm 5'11", or at least I was 5'11". I think I've shrunk an inch. in my sock feet, so I was nothing but skin and bones, believe me. And I didn't have the energy to cook, and the extent of my cooking was to open a can of soup when I heard my husband coming through the door and heat it up and put it on the table. And he got pretty sick of canned soup. And to this day, I don't open a can of soup. If I can't make it, we don't have it. But eventually, the bottom hit, and I reached out for help, and I went into this treatment center in Winnipeg. And as I said, after a few days in there, and the fog started to clear, and I heard them say, rarely have we seen a person fail. And as I sat in that meeting room that we used to have there, and I would look around the room, and there were some people that were in the same kind of shape that I was in, and that there were some that were a little bit better, and there were some that were doing very well. And I got this glimmer of hope that maybe, just maybe, if I listened and did the things that they asked me to do, that I too could change the way I was living. And so I made a decision then that I would make the most of those 3 weeks that I was going to be there. Because I lived 200 miles from Winnipeg. It wasn't a trip that I made very often in those days, and it's not a trip I make very often today. And so I knew that I had to get everything that I could in those 3 weeks, because I didn't even know whether there was an AA group in the small town that I came from. And so when the girls would come in from the meetings when I first arrived, and they were talking about themselves as an alcoholic, and they were talking about me, and it was like somebody lifted a weight off my shoulders, because I knew then that I wasn't alone. And I found out that I was a sick person and not a bad person, and that there was hope. And so I really did try to make the most of those 3 weeks that I was in Winnipeg. And by that time, I had already accepted step one, that I was powerless over alcohol, and certainly my life was unmanageable. But when I came to step two and step three, and especially step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as I understood Him, I did not understand Him. I had been brought up very religiously. I believed in God. I just thought He had quit believing in me, and I had got a long ways away from Him. There were times when I thought, maybe I should try praying. And just as instantly I would think, but He wouldn't listen anyway. Now, I don't know where that concept came from. Certainly, I'm sure it didn't come from my upbringing. It didn't come from the 5 years I spent in a convent boarding school. But I really had to search to find a God that I could relate to. And that was where step 11 came in for me. That I could seek through prayer and meditation. And so when I went home from River House, and I was getting up in the morning and starting to read my book and asking for a little help to stay sober today, and I began to look at the prayer in step three, and I realized that I couldn't live the old way. I couldn't use the old ideas that I had. I had to find a God that I could relate to, somebody that I could talk to, somebody that I didn't have to fear. And I liked the prayer in step three. And I started saying that every morning. And eventually I got so that I was saying the prayer of St. Francis that's given to us in step 11. And I used those two prayers to start my day off and to do a little bit of reading and to just ask God to keep me sober today. Because believe me, I didn't know that it was possible to stay sober for any length of time. And yet, each day was getting better. And actually, when I look back on it, it got better very quickly, considering the state of health I was in when I came here. Just by doing a few simple things that it asked us to do in the program, and by trying to do the steps. I came home from River House on the 3rd of December, and Christmas was coming up, and my husband asked his sister, who worked in one of the local stores, if she knew what I would like for Christmas. And she said, I don't think it really matters. She's so happy these days. So that was how quickly the evidence showed of how my life was changing. But of course, it meant doing the rest of the steps. And certainly after doing step four and step five and clearing away the records of my past and going on to ask God to remove my shortcomings, and I got to step eight where it said, make a list of the persons we had harmed. Well, the first person on the list that I had harmed was my husband. But I made a vow to myself that I would never tell him I was sorry again, because I had told him so many times that I was sorry. And at the time, I meant it. I really meant it. I didn't want to hurt him. I didn't want to do the things that I was doing. But I didn't know that I didn't have any control over that. So I made a decision that I would show him by my actions and not have to say I'm sorry. And the next person on my list was my boss. But I found on my list, and all the people that I listed, that every time I became willing to make that amend, the situation just presented itself to me. It was uncanny. But one of the most important people I had to make an amend to was my boss, because he had put up with a lot of nonsense from me. I worked in an office that was upstairs, and so I was alone most of the time, and so I could sit there for hours and hold my head and do nothing. And so, you know, I really had to make an amend to him. And so one day I said to him, you know, my program, and he had great respect for Alcoholics Anonymous because he'd had a few employees that had, you know, needed it. So he had a great respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, you know, I have to talk to you about the things that I did when I was drinking. And he said, oh, but you're sober now and you're doing a good job and we don't have to talk about that. He said, that's behind us, and we carry on. And I thought, oh, that's good and that's fine. And I went on my merry way for a little while, and then this, you know, conscience that digs at me here in my stomach started to tell me, no, this wasn't right. And so finally I said to him, you know, I have to tell you about the things that I did, and this is part of my program, and I must do it if I'm going to stay sober. So he sat down and listened to me, and when it was all finished, he said, well, I'm glad you told me all that. Now that's in the past. You're doing a good job, and we'll carry on. And we did. And he eventually sold the business, and I moved on into a business of my own. But we became great friends. And I'd worked for him for about 20 years, I guess, so we knew each other very well. And he moved to the coast, and I would go visit him. And then he bought himself, at age 80, he bought himself a computer, and he started emailing me. And so 2 years ago, at age 92, I got an email in January that said he was dying of cancer. And so I decided to sit down and write him a letter. And I did that. Told him all the, you know, the things that he had done for me. And for giving me a second chance when I came home from River House after being in treatment for 3 weeks and going back to him to see if I still had a job. But I think he knew that sober I was a good employee. And so he was quite willing to take a chance on me. But I'd never really thanked him for that. So I thanked him for giving me a second chance and for all the things that he had meant for me in the years that I had worked for him. After he died, I got an email from his daughter who said that he had read that letter many times, kept it on the dining room table by his chair, and showed it to a lot of people. And so, you know, many years later, even though I had made the amend that I needed to make, I certainly have always been grateful that I took the time to sit down and write that letter. Because we never know the people that we affect and how they can affect other people with the sobriety that we get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Step 12, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. And I think to me, you know, the practicing the principles in all our affairs, to me, was to become a citizen of my community again, and to be the responsible person that I knew I could be and that I could be as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and working these steps. And so I went on to go into business for myself. And I had an income tax business. And the irony of it is that, you know, if I had been drinking, and tried to set up an income tax business, can you imagine how many people would bring their income tax to you when you were drinking? And I managed to develop quite a good business. And I owed it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when I was 11 months sober, I got involved in service. And just sort of by accident that I ended up attending a meeting that was a couple of the speakers were former present trustees on the General Service Board. One was trustee at large for Canada and the other was the Western Canada Regional Trustee. And I got inspired and got involved in service. And when you have a group of about five people, you don't get elected to much, so I was appointed to be the GSR and I was asked to be the district committee member and finally got elected to be alternate delegate and then got to serve my provinces as delegate for 78 and 79. And then in 83 was elected to serve on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous that I mentioned as trustee at large for Canada. And as a result of being the trustee at large for Canada, I was the World Service Delegate. And the first World Service meeting that I attended was in New York in 84. And then I got to go to Guatemala in 86. And Don Fritz and I were there together. You know, you don't get to where I am today from where I came from. It just doesn't happen anyplace else. You know, this has been just an incredible journey in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. Where else would I have, even before I drank, would I have ended up in places that I never thought possible with people that I don't know from Adam, but I know. The first night I was in Guatemala, and I was met at the airport by a guide who was an AA member, and he whisked me off to an AA meeting. And we drove down the street in Guatemala, and it seemed to me, if my memory serves me correct, we just parked on the street, and we walked down the street and walked around the corner and went into almost a hole in the wall, and there was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous taking place. And they were all speaking Spanish, and they asked me to share, and of course I didn't speak Spanish, and they didn't speak English, and I spoke in English, and they spoke in Spanish, and we understood each other. Because Alcoholics Anonymous really is the language of the heart. I could have never dreamed on that day in November 1970 when I reached out for help. I had no intentions that I would be sober for any length of time. I'm sure it was a matter of trying to get everybody off my back and get some sort of normalcy back into my life and maybe quit drinking for a year. I never expected that 30-some years later I'd still be sober. That wasn't in the cards. And I could have never imagined, if somebody had told me then, the places that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous would take me, I could never dream possible. And that night in Guatemala, when we all stood to say the Serenity Prayer in all the different languages, I realized it was a long ways from where I'd come from. God works in mysterious ways. Why I've been blessed to do the things I've done, I have no idea. But I know I'm here today. I'm sober. This is, I think, my fifth international convention. I went to the first one in when I was sober almost 10 years. I went to New Orleans. Montreal, I was serving on the board of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, so it was very special to have that international in my own country. I went to Seattle in 1990 and San Diego in 95. And I had all my reservations and meals and everything booked for Minneapolis when my husband was called for surgery. And if you wait for a year and a half to have hip replacement surgery, you don't postpone it. So I had to cancel my trip to Minneapolis. But I was more than happy to come to Toronto, and especially, again, being in our own country of Canada, and say Happy Canada Day to everybody. You're all Canadians today. And just thank you for being here. Thank you for your service. And thank you to God. My understanding today that I can relate to and talk to and feel personal about. And thank you to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time left here in our allotted time slot, and this is nothing that I discussed with our speakers before the meeting, but since I'm the chairman, I guess I can do anything I want. Anybody out here have any questions for our three presenters here this morning? Yes. Could you speak up, and then I'll repeat your question in the microphone? Donna? Does anyone have a specific question for one of our speakers? Yes, ma'am. Is that for Scott or for me? Well, we'll just get it out of the way right now. I shouldn't say get it out of the way. What is the group conscience here? Would people like to close this meeting when we do close with the Lord's Prayer? I think that says we're probably going to do it that way. So, okay. No. I do have one thing I'd like you all to help me with, too. I came to this conference today, or this weekend, with my 15-year-old daughter, Allie. And she's looking at me with daggers right now. But this is her very first conference ever. And I'd like you all to help me make her feel welcome by saying, "Hi, Allie." The young lady that was making the comments for Scott, if you'd like to talk to him after the meeting, he'll be around, okay? Any other questions for the speakers? Okay. I'd like to thank our speakers. Let's give them another round of applause. What we've learned here today is that if you're just coming to AA and not drinking and going to meetings and reading the big book, that's not what our program is. I used to read a lot of science fiction. I never learned to fly a spaceship one time, you know. If you are not working the steps, I invite you to become a member and join our fellowship. Let's share a moment of silence to be used as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer, if you would care to join in. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy Lord be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen. Thank you. Thanks for that.